I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Postcards from a Dying World. I have the author of one of my top five books of last year and probably one of my top five books of this year. And Lavi Tidar and I have been nerding out about Philip K. Dick for about a half an hour already off air. And Lavi Tidar is the World Fantasy Award-winning author of Osama, which if you go to my other podcast, Dickheads, and you can hear our 10th anniversary conversation about Osama, which is one of my favorite pink beam fictions, where I feel like Lavi, you were riding the pink beam a little bit, riding that one. And maybe so with Neom. Is that how you say it? Neom? That's how I've been saying it.
I think so. I didn't actually come up with the name. it's a real made up place.
Yeah.
In Saudi Arabia. So yeah, I think that's how you. By the way, I should point out World Fantasy Award, no Philip K. Dick Award.
Yeah, we gotta Circumference of the World should do that, I think.
They nearly gave it to me. I never got nominated for the Philip K. Dick, which, you know, is the one award I actually won because of Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
And then they nearly gave it to me for The Escapement a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
They gave me something called a special citation, which means you almost won it, but you didn't actually win it. So,
well, you're certainly...
I just wanted for the connection.
Yeah, well, if there was ever a book deserving, I don't know how Neom didn't get nominated. It's we'll talk about how Dickian it is. I'm sure we'll get into that. But Lavi Tidar, welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. I am so stoked to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me vent about my.
Hey, no, I totally understand. So if people want it, we got into a little bit of your background on the Dickheads episode, and I recommend people listen to that, but you're a science fiction fan and reader and writer who grew up in Israel originally, but you live currently in England. But tell the folks a little bit about how you got into science fiction, and then we'll launch into these books.
I think you're just born into it, aren't you? I don't really know, because the children's library we had, you didn't really have anything that was designated science fiction. It was just always being attracted to the weirder takes on reality, I guess. And then once from a very young age, and then getting into science fiction in the adult library, which was a big, big step when you're that age. But what I discovered is I used to literally sort of hide in this nook that was made up of one shelf of crime intersecting with science fiction. And I always thought science fiction was the stronger influence. And then I'm kind of discovering that I probably absorbed quite a lot of the crime stuff just by sitting close to it.
Right. Well, and so you're a person that is super knowledgeable or interested in the history of the genre as well. Which will be evidenced by some of the things we talk about to do with these last two books, especially Circumference of the World, which is your most recent release. But so what if people want a primer for what we're going to be doing here is we're going to be mostly talking about your most two recent books that I know of, Neom and Circumference of the World, because I just read them and I'm going crazy for them. So I want to talk about those two books, but do you also have a Judge D book coming out soon too, which is just mind blowing to me, right?
Well, I'm hoping to collect the Judge D stories. It's sort of, they were always meant to kind of be a continuing adventure. So We'll see. But the funny thing is, over here in the UK, I'm actually doing literary novels now. So I get to kind of pretend that all this genre stuff is way beneath me, I'll be honest. But also, as I found out, no one actually reads literary fiction. So I think definitely science fiction is the way to go. It's like, to all the science fiction writers out there, don't give up your day jobs. Like,
And write literary
don't try to
fiction.
move up.
Well,
But
and
yeah,
for
these are the
people,
most recent ones in the US.
yeah, and for people who don't know, Judge D was a kind of Sherlock Holmes like character in Chinese literature who was translated. There's just tons of Judge D stories, and recently Choi Hark did a couple Detective D movies, so it kind of reignited the thing. And I'm a huge fan of those movies. I've read a couple of the novels. They skirt fantasy and weirdness, and some of them get weirder than others. And so I was really excited when I saw that you that you were writing Judge D's stuff, continuing adventures, because
I kind of made a mistake on this because I'm a Judge D fan as well, so I like the Van Gulik, English language or whatever. They weren't English originally, were they? They were Dutch, I think. But the sort of mysteries and then the Chinese movies that came out. So Judge D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame,
Flame.
I think it was. And which is such a great steampunk movie, So people always think I just nicked it from this Dutch guy, and I'm like, no, I'm nicking it from a whole other bunch of people. But the mistake I made, I never thought it was going to be a series. I was just writing one story as a way of trying to do a sort of almost like a Three Laws of Robotics with vampires. I don't know what I was thinking. So I just called him Judge D because I thought that's kind of a nice little throwaway reference. And it was only because Jonathan Strahan at Tor, he kind of said, yeah, I'll take it. And can you write some more? And I was like, of course I can't write anymore. I don't know how to write Miss Golden Age mysteries. And I ended up writing a lot of them. So I get people occasionally going, oh, why is he doing Judge D? He's taking it from. And I'm like, it was pure accident. I should have called him Judge Lee, which I think Judge Lee does show up at some point.
So, your most recent releases here in the States are Neom and Circumference of the World. These are the ones we're going to talk about. But let's start with Neom, which is that takes place in, you have a series of science fiction novels that are kind of set in a shared universe that I believe was first collected in Central Station, which is the first of your works that I read. And I think I read Central Station when I wasn't quite as primed for getting on the tracks that you're laying down. I liked it at the time. I remember I liked it, but for whatever reason now, like when I read Neom and the Circumference of the World, I feel like I feel like I'm on a bullet train to my imagination, basically, because you do a lot of the things that I love to see. And one of the things that makes Neom feel golden age, and this is one of the things that I said I liked about Neom, is because it feels like old science fiction, but also modern at the same time, which is what I would like more of, right? Is that it almost feels like a fix-up novel, even though it's not, right? Like, because that, well, it's all coherent and it comes together, and it almost has this feeling of passages or vignettes that eventually tie together. Did you write Neom completely as a novel? Did you have it planned as a novel, or did you collect things together?
Yeah, I mean, Neom was a weird one. Central Station was designed to be a novel from the beginning, which I think people don't quite often don't realize. But I never thought anyone would buy it. So my logic was, if I can do it as a series of more or less standalone short stories, I can at least publish the short stories. I knew I could do that. I never thought anyone would actually publish the novel. It's one of my biggest mistakes, I have to admit, because it's one of the books that did very well for me in the end. But that was one of the reasoning was I'm going to try and imitate an old fix-up novel and at least sell it individually. With Neom, it wasn't like that at all. I was actually working on that huge literary novel that I was doing at the time, and it was the second lockdown over here.
Yeah.
And my brain simply couldn't cope with, you know, a huge amount of historical fiction and all the complications. And I ended up writing Neom just as an escape. And that's why all the chapters are so short, because my attention span, like, I can do a little bit at a time. I can do a little bit. And it was just fun. And I had no, it was also one of those books where I literally had no idea where it was going. I was just writing it to figure out what this robot is doing, why it's buying a flower, why is it digging in the desert. So yeah, it was very much kind of done quite quickly as well. It was just done in one go. And I was really relieved when it kind of reached an ending, and I thought, oh, that actually worked. You know, you never know if it's going to work.
Right. And so the setting is this fictional Saudi city of Neom. Was Neom something that was kind of in the back of your that city in the back of your imagination when you were working on Central Station? Because I don't remember if it was mentioned or not in Central Station. But
Neom is a fairly new thing. I mean, it was basically, and it's not fictional. In they're building it. I actually know a Spanish engineer who's over there right now. You know, to build it. It has an airport. It has an airport. It doesn't have much else going on, but it has an airport. And I came across it very early on when he just literally had a marketing video on YouTube, and the marketing video was pictures of the botanical gardens in Singapore. You know, it was very, and I thought it was such a ridiculous idea that it was kind of a fun science fictional concept. And I think I ended up writing, what ended up being the first chapter of the novel is actually a short story that I published in Asimov earlier on. And that set, you know, that was in a way set very early on in the city. And the novel itself, which I started writing from a different place, which I started writing with a robot, that really kind of takes it much further into the future.
Well, and I guess the origin of this novel being like a fun escape from writing something else kind of makes sense, because I think one of the things that I like about Neom is it has this feeling, it has a very fun, playful attitude towards science fiction. Like it feels like a tribute to Golden Age science fiction, in the sense that it's just being very playful with the humor, with and that's one of the things about Philip K. Dick that I think gets underrated is the humor, because he was very funny. And so there's kind of a half step off reality, little bit in the future, and then themes of religion and reality, you know, mixed in with his humor. So that's why I feel it's very or fits well with not just PKD, but with New Wave, with that transitional era between what Neom feels like to me is that transitional era where Golden Age is bleeding into the New Wave. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love science fiction from a wide range of eras. And I think it's kind of interesting to see how different it gets in the different decades. You know, if you look at the 1950s science fiction, it's so noirish, it's paranoia, it's, you know, it's written almost like pulp noir, a lot of it. And then the 60s, they just go into a lot more color and hippies and drugs and sex. The 70s go into the old ecological thing, you know, the 80s hit you with the cyberpunk. So it's kind of taking from all of this stuff, you know. The 1930s with the weird tales stuff. I really kind of love all of it.
Well, and this story is set in the Middle East, and we don't get a ton of English language science fiction set in the Middle East. So I feel like, you know, that gives it a somewhat different feeling from some of the modern science fiction we're getting. But how important is it for you to give a science fictional voice to this region of the world? Because I think it's great.
Well, I mean, it's more a case that I can't really write about America, you know. I think actually what I've been trying to do recently is write a book about America, but write it in the way Americans would write about anywhere else.
Right.
So without any regard to authenticity whatsoever, you know. So America clearly has capital city, and in capital city there's the presidential palace, and you know, things like this. Like I'm just gonna make up an America that I don't really know. You know, that was kind of fun to do, but I have to be able to write about places that I sort of know, and I have to be able to write it in a way that's sort of convincing, I guess. And
Well,
also, I just like the idea. I mean, initially with Central Station, I like the idea of an entire science fiction universe where you never mention America once. You know, it's kind
right.
of, it was designed as a kind of antidote to American science fiction. So instead of action adventure plots, there's hardly anything happening. You know, there's America never gets mentioned. I don't think in the entire universe, in all the material I've done, it ever gets mentioned. It's only recently that I've put a couple of reluctant mentions to Europe. So even that barely appears.
Well, which is great. And one of the things that I think, you know, one of the reasons why those of us who are dickheads that love Phil, for example, is that he's not, in his era, he was not writing about the scientists and the leaders as much as, you know, he had people that were adjacent to power. Usually the second character introduces, as we learn. But you know, his main characters a lot of times were plumbers or people who couldn't afford to pay to open their door, or whatever. And what I think makes your fiction separate, different in a similar sense is that that Europe and America are not mentioned or are not part of it, and you don't miss it. You know, you're fully engrossed in this world, and I think at the same time too that makes sense because people in that part of the world, that's their life and their existence, and I love that about it in the future. So was the scene where the robot buys the rose, I think this was the spark of the idea, right? Like, and what I like about the speculative irony here is that it uses, you know, world building to establish the universe. Is so much is said about what the robots do and the robots' role in society just by like that whole conversation that happens with the robot at the flower shop. And I don't want to give away the whole book, right? But at the same time, like that whole what the robot's role in the society of Neom was a lot of the driving force of this novel, right?
Well, I mean, what happened was I thought I had the image of the robot buying a rose. That's all I had. And I wrote it as a, I thought it would be like a little short story that I'm writing just to, you know, do something. And when, I don't know if you remember, when you get to the end, he goes and he takes the flower to the desert and he puts it down. And then there's a scorpion and the robot kind of looks at the scorpion and then he just squashes it underfoot, which I thought was a horrible thing to do. So I'm sort of like looking at, I wrote it and I'm looking, I'm like, why did it kill the scorpion? That seems like a really out of character, you know, that seems quite mean. Like, who is this robot? You know, so I write another section just to see what the robot is doing, and then it's digging in the desert, you know, and he's digging up body parts, robotic body parts in the desert. I'm like, why is he doing that? You know, what is this robot up to? So it was really about just trying to find. So I wrote another one, then I realized I'm basically writing a book to try and answer that question.
Right. And I think one of the things that, you know, the orbit around the robots and all the things that happens in the city, the setting of Neom becomes like a really fascinating like future study. I know like when Phil was writing, he didn't worry about whether this was a realistic future or not, or this could happen. Do you try to write hard science fiction, or do you care if it's, I'm wondering if you think about realism or if you're more interested in the science fictional surrealness of it when you're writing?
I mean, yeah, the only thing I really care about is that my background is in computers, you know, in internet, the early internet. That's where I shone briefly. And it always annoys me that science fiction writers don't understand how computer networks work, you know. and they don't understand AI, they don't understand computers, you know. That's why I always like Greek gods in science fiction, you know. They're like Deus Ex Machina. They don't understand how networks work, or they don't even have them in the stories. And so that's the one thing that I'm kind of anal about. When Central Station came out, I was kind of horrified because I can't remember if I told you last time. So I saw a press release from this company, Silicon Valley, and they said, literally said, we want to build the internet the way it's described in Central Station, in this book, Central Station. And I was like, I'm not sure that's like a great idea, you know. So one of the things I've done, I've got a book coming out in June, and it's a children's book, and it's called The Children's Book of the Future, which I wrote with a friend of mine who's a futurist. And it's almost like cannibalizing the Central Station universe for kids, you know. But the idea is to show optimistic visions of what the future can be like.
Yeah.
You know, and explain a little bit about the science behind even some of the most outlandish concepts, you know. And I wanted to put all the sense of wonder sci-fi into it. So it ends with a Dyson sphere, you know, which is kind of the biggest sci-fi concept you can have. But even with the Dyson sphere, we kind of have an aside that says, you know, Dyson spheres are cool, but riding your bike is also kind of cool, like, and it's like much simpler technologically, you know. Maybe you should just get out there. So it's not about having, you know, realistic futures. It's about, well, I mean, on the other hand, I don't think anything I write is flat out impossible. You know, I don't have travel. I don't have faster than light travel. I don't have aliens, which I just because I'm not very, you know, aliens are always just based on Earth animals, aren't they, essentially? So I need to find like a cool angle.
Maybe Lem, the Stanislaw Lem, but yeah.
Well, Philip K. Dick always had good aliens, didn't he? Because they were so out there.
He had some good ones, and I think Ray Naylor is writing, or you know, writing good non-human life, and Mountain in the Sea. I thought he did a real good job with that, but. I will say another writer that I think is writing, is trying to write optimistic future, which, you know, I find challenging as a pessimist, is S.B. Divya. Her Maru and Machinehood, I thought both kind of kinship with your somewhat optimistic futures. And that's the thing is I think Neom, I do think has a kind of optimistic look at the future. It's not perfect, you know. There's definitely a caste system there in future Saudi Arabia, but you know, it is what it is. Now, I do want to point out. Well, go ahead if you.
No, I'm saying I'm actually like you. You know, and most of my books tend to be incredibly grim and, well, no, very funnily grim, I should say. But I'm not a naturally optimistic person. But I think what it is, I love playing with the toys of the Golden Age, and I can't play with those toys if the Earth is a barren wasteland with right. toxic seas. You know, I've got to kind of say, well, we haven't destroyed the planet. We have built space travel and robots and AI and biomodification, because that's the cool stuff. And I didn't actually realize I was optimistic until Central Station came out and people started saying that this was optimistic as SF. But I've become more convinced that that's not a bad thing, that we're offering some sort of hope, maybe.
Right. Well, and playing with those toys, speaking of, there's lots of fun Easter eggs that I'm sure. And I know from kind of doing this, because I do this as well in my fiction, is like sometimes you just want to, you know, shout out and nod to the people who inspired you. But obviously the boppers and the Mad Rucker, that's a tribute to Rudy Rucker, I take it, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of acknowledge the influence. I mean, look, the nice thing about old science fiction is no one reads it anymore. No, I'm not talking about really specifically. I'm talking about the older stuff. But
Yeah.
I'm saying so you can steal it and make it new again, you know. But I think
And
it's
then
nice to
assholes like me are
acknowledge.
the ones that point it out in book reviews, so.
Well, I think it's nice to acknowledge it. So you're not just being a thief. You can say actually it's homage, you know. So
Yeah.
I love Rudy's boppers, you know. But if I was going to put boppers in, I had to acknowledge their creator. And also, I just love the idea of Matt Drucker, the terror artist, you know. So.
Yeah. And the terror artist, well, and before we get into the terror artist, that was a good one, but a deeper cut was the data vampire being named Shamblo. I saw you. I saw you. C.L. Moore went, her dorm that she lived in college was a three, or it was like a 5 minute walk from where I grew up in Indiana. So, shout out to C.L. Moore, Catherine Lucille Moore.
I'm a big fan. I think that's pretty obvious, you know. I mean, none of these things, you know, that they're if people get the reference, that gives you a little bit of extra appreciation for it. If you don't get it, you don't need to get it. You know, that's kind of it's a bit like a Disney movie, you know, you want to put the jokes for the adults, but the kids should enjoy it just as much. Sorry, that might have sounded very condescending, so not meant that way.
And I will say that the building where she worked at Fletcher Trust is still exists. It's a hotel now, but the mail slot where she dropped her submissions to Weird Tales is still in the lobby. So,
Wow.
yeah, in Indianapolis. So when people go to visit the Ray Bradbury Center, it's a 5 minute drive from the Ray Bradbury Center. You can see that too. The terror artists were an interesting concept in the book. I really thought they were interesting. Where did that come from?
I mean, I think that really starts, you know, from when I was writing Osama, which Osama itself came from these experiences I had kind of getting close to these terrorist attacks and so on. But what occurred to me is that any terrorist attack is a media event. It's a media act. You know, there's no point just blowing something up unless people can see it and experience it. So from that came the idea of terror artists who do it not for political reasons, but purely for artistic reasons. Thankfully, I don't think they actually exist. They'd be complete psychopaths. But
No,
yeah, but you know.
it was an interesting commentary on I hadn't thought about like the whole the media event thing of it. And last question I have about Neom is there's the whole when Nasir asks, you know, what do ro robots dream about? And you know, here you get to really, that's really a conversation, you know, basically with Phil through the fiction. Because, you know, obviously the question, do androids dream of electric sheep, is, you know, right there in the title. And Lelia says maybe they dream of freedom. Like, were you wanting to have that conversation with Phil through the fiction, or is that just a moment that kind of happened by accident?
No, I mean, there's so much Philip K. Dick woven through this book. I mean, if you look at the robots that show up, you know, they're sort of his old buddies from the war. Each of them is from a different science fiction creation. So we've got, you know, we've got the Clifford Simak robot, the Jenkins, and we've got the Fondly Fahrenheit android from Fondly Fahrenheit, Bester, and then we've got the Philip K. Dick one, the Tasso. Who actually comes back? There's another Tasso coming back in my next sort of Central Station book. So it's all part of the DNA, you know. It's all part of. I mean, I don't think you know, I'm not trying to write anything imitating Philip K. Dick. I'm just kind of weaving all those influences into the book. Also, you know, a lot of the time when I write short fiction, I want to hit that specific note. That is sort of vaguely Philip K. Dickian, and I'll go back and I'll read only his early stuff, you know, like Beyond Lies the Wub, which is such a great, funny science fiction story, and Rogue, which was his first published story, I think, or the first story he wrote, which is such an amazing paranoid, you know, paranoid noir story. And all you have to do is almost read like a few lines and you get his voice in the back of your head. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. As somebody who just spent a whole time, well, I was trying to imitate him recently. So I know what you're saying. Absolutely.
mean, I get this.
Go ahead.
Now, I get the same thing with, say, if I want to write something that is sort of cyberpunky, all you really have to do is go back and read a few lines from, Johnny Mnemonic or from Burning Chrome, and you get that voice again, sort of whispering,
Yeah, and what I would do when I was writing Great America and Dead World is before I started writing, every time I'd just randomly pull a PKD off the shelf. This is my PKD shelf right here. And I would just read a couple pages of the opening chapters, especially because the opening chapters are always the most world building, and just like try to get a sense or a feeling for that voice. And one of my favorites to do that with is Galactic Pothealer is one of my favorites for because I just love the voice in that one, and where he was coming from at that time.
I mean, to me, his most in, the most important influence he has on what I do is that, as you said earlier, that he focuses on little people. It's not about action heroes. It's not about evil dictators or, space billionaires. We're getting a lot of that at the moment. It's about little people and little lives, and that's really what I wanted to replicate. I wanted to write about people who just try and do the best they can. And they just happen to be living against this shiny science fiction background, but they just have the same life they would have had 500 years before.
You'll see when I send you the formula, he straight up calls that character the subhuman character. But then also goes on to say that you can't lampoon them, that that was a problem that Pohl and Kornbluth fell into.
Right.
Word for word, he says that. So, but enough about that. Yeah, I think Neom is a great book. There's a lot of humor. There's the robot who spent a couple of years being a toilet. Trying to understand humans, and there's all kinds of really it's just a it's a re I think what really works for that book is it feels old school, and that's one of the reasons why I loved it. And as somebody who reads a lot of retro science fiction, and I know you mentioned Cord Wainer Smith as being one of the huge influences on it. I just did a tear of Cord Wainer Smith, including reading the 1950s library copy of his Psychological Warfare history, which was not as
Wow.
fun. But Cord Wainer Smith, how was wh why did you point to him as an influence? What was his influence on this work?
What I really like that he does, is he has that technique that he casually mentions something. He doesn't world build in the sense that here is a manual on how this world works. Here is There's a flower that only blooms on the 8th day of the 7th month on the southern continent, whatever. He just casually mentions something that happened 500 years ago and has become myth by that point. And you have no idea what it's about. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll run into another story where he actually covers that. But just as much of his universe, we never get to see. We just get hints of it. So that's something that I very much do with the Central Station universe. Is that I'll have a lot of very casual references to things, and some of them I have covered, like I thought they were interesting enough to write a story on, and some of them probably I haven't, and they're just a casual reference to something that may or may not even exist. But it's that sense of a future mythology or a future, the idea of a future history, that the stuff that we're reading now is already old. It's already a story that's been told and retold and happened a long time ago. That only happens to be the future to us, the readers, but not to the people in the book.
It's funny because I had been saving Cord Wainer Smith for a long time. Like I hadn't really read him, and then I just went on a tear a couple months ago, and people were right. But I've also been saving where his Science Fiction Hall of Fame story for because I'm doing it on this podcast. We're doing monthly coverage on the Science Fiction Hall of Fame stories, so I've been saving his one from there.
Okay.
And so you're more than welcome to join that panel if when we get there. I know
I
you can't.
adore Cordwainis Smith.
Well, you know who introduced me to him to me was Brian Evanson. And who I think Brian Evanson, in my opinion, is one of the best short story writers like on the planet right now. And he was when I had when he came on for Canticle for Leibowitz, I said, "Is there any author I might not have read that I must read?" And he said Cordwainer Smith, and that was and I admit that was the first time I had heard of him. And I now. But I mean, I'm more of a nerd for this stuff now than I was even 5 years ago. So, like, and speaking of that, a book that really dives into that is Circumference of the World. What's the origin story for Circumference of the World? Was this also like a diversion from the literary work, or was this one? Yeah.
No, this one's the exact opposite. This is the most complicated and longest and most futile attempt at writing a book. So if Neon was the easy, the easy side of the scale, this was the worst one. Although you missed a nice segue into this, that of course Cordwainis Smith published the first story by L. Ron Hubbard
Yes.
in the school magazine, which I always because we were talking about Le Guin and Philip K. Dick kind of going to school together and not knowing each other. And people
Yeah.
don't realize that Cordwainis Smith and L. Ron Hubbard also knew each other in some capacity. The Circumference of the World went through about a 10-year development period with two failed manuscripts, multiple revisions. It started off as a big book that then became a short book. It's been a difficult, and and at the end of it, you think, was it worth it? Like, was it worth it? But well, I think it came out pretty well in the
I
end.
think it's genius, but personally, was the longer version, did it have more of Lodestar in it, the novel within the novel, or
No.
no?
One of the problems I actually had with the novel within a novel is that it was, it's dreadful, essentially, and. Originally, the story was told in five different strands instead of being separated. I ended up separating them very much near the end. And one of the problems with the novel within the novel was, I was talking to the publisher and he said, because they just kept coming up as bits, and he goes, yeah, the problem is they're really bad science fiction. And I said, I know, like they're supposed to be. But it turned out that once you compress them, once you put them together, they worked, they were fine. And actually, one of the most annoying reviews for the book said, that was the per best part of the book. I just wish the rest of the book was like it. So,
Well,
someone
I will
just
say,
wanted to write my idea of a 1950s sci-fi novel.
and I actually, well, I like that part too. I like it for how cheesy and it is, it works in
Thank
that.
you.
Hey, not everybody has the balls to write an entirely bad on purpose novel like Norman Spinrad did with Iron Dream,
Yeah,
which,
but to be fair, the Iron Dream is impossible to read.
Yeah.
I mean, this was still designed to be a readable, like it's a reasonable pastiche of a babe. It's not completely sort of unreadable. I'm sure
Yeah.
you would agree with me. I think it was this, Iron Dream was designed to be unreadable, basically.
It was. It was. And it's funny because the literary experiment of Iron Dream is so ridiculous that it's amazing that it happened, it's just funny. But I would say with Lodestar, the novel within the novel is actually fun. So
Yeah,
that's different. It's not the
because
same.
I think that's also a hallmark of that time. Those books were fun, those stories were fun, and it's not long, it's just long enough to not overstay its welcome as well. So
Yeah.
it's
So if people don't know, if they may, Circumference of the World is a science fiction novel that I think maybe the elevator pitch is what if Scientology was real, or
No. It's what if L. Ron Hubbard was right?
What if L. Ron Hubbard was right?
Which is a different, nothing to do with Scientology. I just like the idea that you had a science fiction writer that came up with some sort of explanation as to what the nature of the universe, and just happened to have been right by accident, you know, which is a lot like Philip K. Dick. I know Philip K. Dick, the last 10 years of his life, he would come to, you know, because I know Powers and Blaylock, and he would come up to them and said, I figured it out, you know, the nature of the universe is this. And he would be entirely convinced. And then in the morning, he would say, no, that was ridiculous. That was a ridiculous concept. But I think today I've got it. You know, and I just love the idea that someone like that accidentally hits on the right idea, but also combined with that certain charm and ruthlessness of L. Ron Hubbard to actually make some money off it.
Well, and science fiction writers have been writing about L. Ron Hubbard since 1941 in Rocket to the Morgue, you know, with Tony Boucher's Rocket to the Morgue, and Phil did it with The Turning Wheel. Right. That had the prophet Elrond and like all that stuff. And, you know, Spinrad, Children of Hamelin. So, like, you know, this is not it's, you know, and we have the master, which, you know, Thomas Anderson sort of writing about Hubbard, too, in a film. So we've had Hubbard fictionalized before. But what I think makes this unique and different is this idea of doing it in the style of the Golden Age and like acknowledging it. So you have in this novel, you have letters from Golden Age figures like Frederick Paul. And I was in the best unique time to read Circumference of the World, because I literally just read Frederick Paul's book, autobiography, right before reading this. And so I kept wondering, or one of the things I wondered was, this book is almost like tuned to my frequency, right? And then I wondered, like, I think this book is genius, but will some of this be lost on some of the people? Like, and you had to know that not everyone's going to get every kind of in joke and thing that's going on here, right? You have to, I mean, I think you're kind of writing a book like this for people like me, right? Is that kind of the idea?
I mean, the problem is I don't write books for anyone other than myself. You know, if someone else comes along for the ride, it's great. But yeah, I don't expect everyone. You know, I had that with, I don't know if you've read it, I wrote a book called A Man Lies Dreaming, which is one of my favorite books. And it's about Adolf Hitler as a private detective.
I have not read that one yet. And
it's a very funny book about the Holocaust. I did a panel at a crime writing festival, and I went on stage and they asked everyone to talk about their new book. And I said, you know, I wrote this book. It's about Adolf Hitler as a private detective. It's not for everyone. You know? And every publishing person in the audience came up to me afterwards and said, you can't say that. You can't say, but I'm like, but it's not for, this book is not for everyone. I wish I could tell you that you could go to the supermarket and buy it at the checkout, but it's clearly not for everyone. But this one, you know, I don't think that you need to know anything about the Golden Age or science fiction necessarily for this book to work. But at the same time, I couldn't honestly tell you because I wrote it. I wouldn't know. Right.
Well, and that's the thing is I can't turn those things off. So when I get to the part that has a letter by Frederick Paul, like I know about, you know, not everyone knows that he, you know, took over Galaxy Magazine over a poker game, you know, like not everyone knows that, but Paul, I do.
Paul is the only one from that period that I actually got to meet.
Yeah.
You know, so that was a big, I have a signed copy of The Way the Future Was. And I sort of kidnapped him, to be honest. I've got the hardback first edition, but you know, who's counting? But no, I did actually kidnap him at some point. We were trying to, and interviewed him for about an hour. And I used a lot, you know, I used his blog as well, because he blogged about this stuff up until his death. So he had a lot of these stories. I read Asimov. I read Rocket to the Morgue, which is really fascinating in the way it depicts, you know, the young L. Ron Hubbard, for example.
Yeah. And I just finished writing an article for Amazing Stories, my Amazing Stories column about Rocket to the Morgue. So I'm pretty
It's
steeped.
you know, it's a lot of it you have to, but the hardest thing with writing the sort of golden age history was really doing Campbell. But it was the hardest and the easiest because, you know, say even if you're reading Lovecraft, Lovecraft kind of has a bit of charm to him, you know, but John W. Campbell had no charm. He was the sort of guy you'd avoid at a party because he was an absolute bore. His letters are basically lectures hitting you over the head with his crazy ideas about stuff. And he's incredibly casually anti-Semitic and racist, as you know. But to copy his style and write in his voice is very easy because I love writing horrible people. So to be casually, you know, when he goes,
I
"You
think,
people," to Isaac Asimov, which he did, you
he's one of
know.
your people, that
One of
Einstein
your,
guy,
you know. And he's like, you know, slavery is good, but being a vegan is bad. You know, stuff. He would just come up with the most ridiculous amount of rubbish. So he was fun to make fun of. But now I just saw someone reviewing the book and calling it an apology of, you know, an apology for Campbell and the Golden Age. And I'm like, have you read the same book I wrote? Like, do you not see what this book is doing? But also, I think the idea of treating a character like Elron Hubbard as a complex character, you know, especially today, some people would just look at it and say, you're not denouncing him as an evil egomaniac or whatever. But
Well, and
I find it a lot more interesting to look at the complexity of characters, which is, you know.
I mean, too, he was. In his time, he was a really great writer too, early on. I mean, Fear and the Final Blackout, are ones that I really think are amazing. And you know, David Gill in his class on PKD talks about like what an influence Fear was, the story Fear on PKD, and I believe it. Like, even
To
if
be honest, what I find fascinating with Hubbard, and I think that comes across in the book, you know, that's kind of the soul of the book, is that he was the one guy, they all wanted to do it, right? Frank Herbert wanted his own religion, Heinlein wanted his own religion, you know, they all kind of aspired, I think, to that mythical level. And he was the guy who kind of took it to the next level. He turned science fiction into a religion. He launched it from the pages of a science fiction magazine. His earliest converts were science fiction fans, which is fascinating in itself. But once he became successful, once he became rich and famous and powerful, I think deep down, all he wanted, he realized, was to just go back to being a science fiction writer. And he missed the days when he was just hanging out with Asimov and Heinlein and drinking beers in the backyard. And he kind of vanishes, he leaves the church. And he goes and he spends the last 10 years of his life in a caravan writing science fiction books. You know, and I thought there's something very sad and very almost touching about it in a way. But also
Yeah, and
I have a soft spot for people who are not particularly nice people, so.
it's well, and you know, it's revisionist history. I mean, a lot of us at the time when we were younger did like Battlefield Earth when we read it. Now it's revisionist to like be like, oh, that was always terrible. And I'm like, no, I liked Battlefield Earth when I read it as a little kid, you know. And I thought it was the greatest epic of all time, and you know, because it was so long and whatever, but because it never seemed to end. And but it's funny too, because I have a very it was I was working at a hardware store when Battlefield Earth came out, and there was a bunch of nerds who all grew up reading and read that book as they were kids, and we all took the day off together to go see the movie. And we had a really like funny experience together, where like, you know, like a few minutes in, we're looking at each other and we're like, nope, no, this did not work. But
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think to me it's a book about science fiction. It's not really a science fiction book. It's a book about science fiction and about that idea, those dreamers, you know, and I have a really good speech that never made it into the book, and I'm going to put it in this hyper limited edition of the book that's going to come out. So that's going to be the only place to find it, which is really annoying. But it's kind of an introduction by the woman who's like the number one fan of my fictional author, you know, sort of the Uber fan who becomes the manager of the church. And she kind of, or, you know, it talks about the passion and the feeling that everything was possible, and you know, there were all these ideas and all these great ideas, and everything could, the future could be better, and people could be making those things. And I think that's really what it's about. It's about the power that a literature can have, and then the reality of what happens when it's actually people who are doing it and not idealized messiahs.
Yeah.
I think I've just lost any readers I may have had left at this point.
No. Well, I think Circumference of the World does talk. I think it's an incredible book. I think it talks about the power of science fiction. It is it's one that you can chew on and think about for a long time. And one of the best compliments I think I can give you, Lavi, is that I think Phil would have loved your work. And one of the things that we in the Philip K. Dick community, like, and the people who are like super nerds and scholars for his work and talk all the time and like, you know, and do festivals together and all that stuff, like a lot of times one of the things that especially David Gill and I talk about is that I think Phil would have, at this point, some of the attention that he gets for like the Valis era and the Pink Beam and all those things, and the whole like Phil was a prophet thing would annoy him at this point, if he were to see the future and see what. And we think, Gil and I, we've talked about a lot, is that we think he would appreciate more the people who looked at him as a writer and looked at his stories and the impact and the power of his stories. And he would like to see his writing live on. And I think what is cool about your work is that I feel like it's in conversation with not just Phil, but Samak. It's in conversation with the Golden Age. And I like modern science fiction. For example, we already talked about S.B. Divya is a great example, or Annalee Newitz. I like the work that they're doing, but they're writing modern science fiction and they're writing it from a modern perspective. And that's great. It's awesome. But what I like about what you're doing is you're in conversation with the history of science fiction. And that's what I really like about your work. And I would like to see more writers of our era, like, acknowledge the history and be in conversation with it. So in that regard, that's my speech about Circumference of the World and why I love it. But
see, the way I look at it, it doesn't even matter, because if no one knows this stuff anymore, then I can steal it ruthlessly and make myself look like a complete genius coming up with all these brilliant ideas.
And then
from the 1930s.
And then I come along trying to teach this history. and
But all literature is in dialogue. You know, you have to be in dialogue with the past. You have to try and move it forward and respect the sources and move forward.
Yeah.
And also just a nice escape from writing these enormous serious books.
What's the next serious book that you have coming out, by the way?
What's the one?
The next serious book coming out.
The next one is a book called Six Lives. They're only coming out in the UK at the moment. Six Lives is sort of like a family epic that stretches from the 1850s to the present day, across six generations of people. See, I am a very serious, pretentious author. I just like to slam it with the robots and the mutants occasionally.
Well, hey, we appreciate when you do. And these are two of my favorite books that I've read recently. I feel especially Circumference of the World felt like it was beamed. I feel like it was pink beamed right into here. I felt it when I was reading it, and I really hope people check it out if they haven't already. I have recommended to people that they start to read these soon, that this interview was coming as of yesterday. I started telling close friends, make sure you read these first. I do think, the fiction that you're writing is a huge part of carrying on that tradition. And so I really appreciate that. And the Mad Rucker and the Shamblo Data Vampire. I see you. I see what you're doing. I know there was you had a Van Vogt in Circumference, and
Oh
you had the
yeah. He
weapon
was one of
shop.
the early. He was one of the early converts for the church. Also, I love his. I love the weapon shops of Ishe. I
Yeah.
just adore those that universe.
Well, one of my dream episodes of Dickheads that we're going to be doing soon is that I want to cover World of Nalle, Solar Lottery, and Malzberg's Gamesmen in one episode, like all three books, because Phil thought he was ripping off World of Nalle with Solar Lottery, and Malzberg thought he was ripping off Solar Lottery with Gamesmen. So I want to
It's just
do.
a game. We're just all ripping each other off
Well,
down the
Malzberg,
eras.
he dedicated that book to Phil, and Malzberg told the story when we interviewed him that when Phil read the dedication, that he immediately called Barry. It just happened to be 2 in the morning in New Jersey when he got the call. And Phil calls you 2 in the morning, you're gonna take that call. And and one of the cool things about this class that we're doing with Gil is a couple of his very good friends who are still alive, Bill Cyril, Linda Castellini, and like they're all in the class, and they get to give us like these l little vignettes of like times they hung out with Phil. It's very cool. But
Oh,
Lavi, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. It's evening there
yeah, the light is slowly vanishing as we speak.
Right. What science fictional works do you have coming up? What can we look forward to?
Well, the children's one, ch the children's book of the future, which is very cool, heavily illustrated. Perfect for anyone who has children, or just likes a pretty book. I might. Well, I've got a bunch of things that are sort of in kind of various stages. I'm hoping that I'll have another Central Station book coming out at some point, which is basically my take on the Martian Chronicles.
Nice.
So Ray Bradbury, watch out! There's a new sheriff in town. No, I thought that was another fun thing to do. And
Right.
if I can keep doing these little books, every year, couple of years, I'd love to just keep doing those Central Station books. And at some point, I'm expected to try and tackle a huge space opera. So we'll see. That might be coming.
Ooh, all right.
Yeah.
Well, Lavi, it was awesome to talk with you today. These two books are definitely some of my favorites, and I will also shout out the Osama interview that we did on Dickheads. Osama is also just a really fantastic book, and for those of you who are looking for what I call pink beam fiction, that one is I think the closest in vibe to Man in the High Castle that I've found in modern fiction. So, and I do not say that lightly. And I would make clear that when if I say something is Phildickian, I do not say that lightly. I have a very high bar for what I call Dickian. It has to be more than just feeling like a paranoid Chase Hollywood PKD. That's a whole other thing. When I say PKD-ish, it means it actually feels like one of his books, not the Hollywood movies that are attached to him. So I do not say that lightly. Circumference of the World is Dickian. It is in the truest sense of the word. So I appreciate that. Is there anything else you want to say to my listeners before we go?
No, very much appreciate that. That's very, very kind of you.
All right. I'm gonna we're gonna go now, and I'm gonna show Lavi one more like a really cool thing, but you people aren't gonna see what it is. So it's for me and Lavi, but if you made it this far, you're an uber nerd, and we'll see you next time. That I believe this episode is going to come right before we do Microcosmic God for the Science Fiction Hall of Fame series.
Oh, nice.
Theodore
Okay.
Sturgeon should be,
Yeah.
yeah. And then we just recorded Roads Must Roll yesterday, so
Okay.
we should right, you're gonna be right smack dab in between those two. So
I know that, and I know that anthology like the back of my hand, as they say. That's my DNA all over.
all right. So, folks, we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. If you made it this far, you're an uber nerd, and mad respect. Later.